Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Brian Lowe, assistant professor of religious studies, about his recent book, Ritualized Writing, Buddhist Practice and Scriptural Cultures in Ancient Japan. Brian, thanks for being willing to do an interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So your book is concerned with the transcribing of Buddhist scripture as a ritual practice in 8th century Japan, in particular what is called the Nara period. So I wonder if you could provide a brief sketch of what Japan looked like in this period, especially in terms of how the society was governed, what the social structure looked like, and what kinds of religious practices were in evidence at the time.
Sure, yeah, that's a wonderful question to start with. So the Nara period, just to kind of familiarize our listeners with what the Nara period is, it refers to a period in Japan from 710 to 784. Some people say 794, but 710 to 784 and 94, when the capital was primarily in an area of Japan known as Nara. The capital actually moved around a little bit, so it's somewhat complicated, but they built a large-scale permanent capital in the city of Nara, which is a wonderful city that you can still visit today. And to understand, I think, the Nara period is actually useful to go back in time a little bit further, because in a lot of ways, the centuries leading up, the century and a half leading up to the Nara period is really a period of beginnings in Japan in lots of ways. In certain ways, it's the beginning of Japan in that kind of right around the Nara period, just before the Nara period, is when we kind of first start to see the word Japan that we use today, Nihon. So it's kind of the birth of an identity of a country. It's in a lot of ways the beginning of literacy. Literacy is an impossibly difficult thing to define, and we do have examples of kind of writing for largely talismanic purposes in Japan from much earlier times. But really from the late 7th century, there's kind of a remarkable increase in evidence of writing. Objects on wooden objects with writing inscribed on them that have been excavated from the ground just emerge in very, very high numbers starting in the late 7th century. So we have kind of this explosion of writing in Japan. Buddhism was introduced to Japan in the mid-6th century, but really starts to kind of take off and spread and take root in, again, kind of the late 7th century. And so this is all kind of the period leading up to the Nara period. So it's really a period of births, of beginnings, of things that are going to be central to Japanese culture. So writing, Buddhism, these types of developments are really coming into play. From the 8th century, we also start to have the emergence of what scholars call the Ritsuryo state. And this is a state that's composed of a series of administrative and penal codes. So we have a much stronger centralized government emerging from this period. And so in a lot of ways, the 8th century is when we start to see a lot of these earlier developments really coalesce in Japan as a bureaucratic state form. I'll talk a little bit more kind of as the interview goes on about the spread of Buddhism, but another thing that's really important for my project is it's also a period where we start to have increasing evidence of a much more widespread emergence of Buddhism across the Japanese archipelago, evidenced both by archaeological remains and by manuscripts, which is really one of the central sources of my project.
So how did you get interested in this particular period of Japanese history?
So I guess there are kind of two stories I could tell in my intellectual origins for how I got interested in Japanese history. And one is a relatively simple story, which is ignorance. Both when I entered graduate school, for one, I was probably one of the most ignorant graduate students to ever enter graduate school. I still to this day think there's some other more qualified candidate with a very similar name whose file got mixed up with my own. And so I didn't know much at all. But one thing that I didn't know, and that it seemed like people in general didn't seem to know much about, was Buddhism in the Nara period. So in English language scholarship, when I started graduate school, there hadn't really been any monograph on Nara period Buddhism. And to some degree, I mean, mine is really one of the first with a few exceptions that kind of look in very different directions than the area that I look in. So when I entered graduate school, the best study of the Nara period, in my opinion, was Yuichi Abe's book on a monk known as Kukai, who's really known as a Heian period monk, which is the period after the Nara period. In the Nara period, I think one of the things Ryuichi Abe does really well in that book is he situates Kukai relative to Nara period Buddhism. And that's an important development because people usually want to see Kukai as this genius that developed his own sect and just kind of invented a whole new form of Buddhism out of nowhere. And Ryuichi Abe situates him very well within Nara period Buddhism. And another Japanese scholar, Fuji Jun, who I spent some time with in graduate school, did similar work in Japanese. But that said, although this is a really fantastic work, it still kind of treats the Nara period as a backdrop for later developments. And nobody had kind of really looked at the Nara period in its own terms. So that's something I kind of wanted to do because no one else had done it. And it's strange to me that something that's really the beginnings of Buddhism in Japan, right? This is the first period where we have a real wealth of written evidence actually from that period. So it's in a lot of ways the first period we can study at from a textual approach. That nobody had ever like looked at it in its own terms before. That was kind of surprising to me. Or very few people had. So that was one of the origins, which is ignorance. The second origin, I guess, would go back to my undergraduate days. And as an undergraduate, I was very interested in Buddhism for a long time, since high school. And when I got to be an undergraduate, I was writing a senior thesis as an undergraduate. I did it on a movement known as Critical Buddhism. And there's since been a very excellent book in English on Critical Buddhism. But at the time, I was doing undergraduate research, or there have been a few books, actually, excellent books on critical Buddhism since then. I was doing undergraduate research on this movement known as critical Buddhism. And one of critical Buddhism's central claims was that Japanese Buddhism was not Buddhism. So they were making this normative claim of what is Buddhism and what's not Buddhism, and for them, things that had to do with emptiness and no self were real Buddhism, and things that didn't were not Buddhism. And so they wanted to claim that Japanese Buddhism was not Buddhism. And they did this for a variety of different ways, some of them doctrinal. But I became very interested in how scholars make normative claims about what is true religion, what's authentic religion, and what is kind of a phony, fake bastardization of that religion. I was very interested, not actually in the substance of what's real and what's not, but what goes into scholars making these types of claims. And I think the period in Japanese history, one of the two periods that's most notorious for being kind of a fake Buddhism, is the Nara period, the other being a much later period, the Tokugawa period, which begins in around the 17th century, which scholars saw as kind of a corruption. But in the Nara period, as I'll talk about probably again later in this interview, people want to dismiss Nara Buddhism as state Buddhism, as a Buddhism where it was just kind of ideological control of Buddhism by the state to support the ruling powers. And so I became very interested in, like, well, what is criticized? And perhaps, surely, it's more complex than that simple narrative. And then how did scholars kind of come about making these narratives? How can we challenge and complicate these narratives? So I both have kind of the origins of this, my interest in this period are both kind of out of ignorance. And then out of kind of the types of narratives that scholars tell about religion and how I might contribute to better understanding religion and moving beyond these kind of authentic and corrupt type of narratives that scholars so often advance.
Right. So, who were the individuals or groups that are central to what you're writing about, who are interested in transcribing scripture, and why would they be interested in transcribing scripture?
So that's a really complex question, and it's also closely connected, I think, to why I got attracted to this project to begin with, why I decided to look at Nara Buddhism through the lens of sutra copying. But before I kind of connect this answer to my previous one, let me just give a little bit of background for our listeners, which is that thinking about scripture copying as a whole, sutra copying as a whole, I want to just stress that it's not only and actually in some ways seldom or not primarily for scholastic purposes. So people aren't necessarily reading a book or copying a book for it to be read to learn something from the content. There's a basic idea, and they do that. That's certainly central, and I'll talk more about that later, why I think that's central. And we shouldn't go too far in saying it's not about interpretation at all. In some ways, it always is. But before I go there, I think it's useful to say that the basic idea in Buddhism is that copying sutras is one of the best things you can do, particularly as a lay patron. And copying sutras itself is thought to generate what's known as merit. So when you do good things in Buddhism, it generates merit. Merit is very helpful because it can do things like ensure that you're going to have a good birth in a next lifetime. You can also transfer that merit to others to ensure they're going to have a good birth so that, you know, you can save your parents, literally save your parents from suffering in hell through copying sutras on their behalf. And so that's just a little bit of background about why anyone in the Buddhist world might copy sutras.
Can you actually, can I interject and just ask you to define what you mean by sutra?
Oh, sure.
For folks that might not know.
So sutra is a particular type of Buddhist text. In the Buddhist canon, it's often defined as the Tripitaka, and it's formed of three baskets, is how they define it. One of these is the Vinaya, the rules for monks and nuns. Another is the commentarial kind of tradition. It's more an abstract kind of philosophical tradition. And then sutras are the texts that are kind of preached by the Buddha. So in some ways, we can almost think of them as recorded Buddhist sermons or scripture. Sometimes I use the word sutra copying in the book to refer to copying of any canonical Buddhist text, and I just use it as a shorthand. Other times, it's referring to kind of this particular genre of text within the Buddhist canon. And so I'll be using that word sutra often in this interview just to mean scripture. So now to kind of go back to your original question, which is who were the individuals or groups who were interested in transcribing scripture and what were some of their reasons for doing so? And I started this off by saying that very question is part of the reason I got into using sutra copying as a lens to understand Nara Buddhism. And the reason for that is, as I mentioned before, there's this state Buddhism model, which has tended to focus on elites, and particularly on the emperor and very, very high-level elites' patronage of Buddhism. One of the things that's interesting about sutra copying, or was interesting to me from the beginning, is we have widespread evidence in manuscript form of a whole range of individuals from all social classes being interested in Buddhism. So men and women, elites, relatively impoverished, high-level aristocrats, low-level bureaucrats. We have evidence of people from all of these different backgrounds, people from the capital, people from the countryside, all of these people being interested in Buddhism. So one of the ways I thought would be useful to critique the state Buddhism model would be to look at a well-documented practice that crosses a variety of social classes. And as I was doing research, I felt like there were two ways to do that. One is archaeological, and the other was kind of a more textual approach. And because of my own training, I felt much more comfortable looking at sutra copying with this wealth of manuscript traditions that could give us insight into Buddhism of people from all social classes. And so when we start to look at this practice and who was involved in it, we see a variety of things. One thing we see is widely shared beliefs across social classes. So for example, the belief that you can use sutra copying in memorial ritual to save your parents and your ancestors from suffering. That's something that we see in prayers by what I'll describe in a few moments as kind of small grassroots communities in the countryside, to the emperor himself being worried about these things. And so we can see shared beliefs across social practices. Shared beliefs across social classes for sutra copying. But then we can also see kind of things that might be somewhat more particular. Kings and queens, for example, and I have a chapter in the book about the queen sponsoring sutra copying projects on behalf of her daughter, would often do it for political reasons. Now, scholars historically focus mostly on display, so we can display our great power by how many sutras we can copy, which is surely something that's there. We also have very particular kind of political situations, as I might have a chance to talk about in more detail later, but very simply, fear of ghosts and demons attacking the crown princess. It might be something that's relatively unique to the emperor and empress copying sutras. Aristocrats copying sutras for a variety of purposes. But then we can also see things, for example, like scribes. And so I also have a chapter in the book on scribes, where I look at one figure that his career is a little bit more complicated than a scribe. He's a scribe, he's a proofreader, and perhaps for most of his career, most importantly, he's a low-level administrator at the scriptorium, kind of a very, very low-level administrator who's managing projects. He's not ranked in the official court system, but he's managing, you know, the receipt of paper, the distribution of the paper to the proofreaders and things like that. He's kind of a low-level manager. And for him, one of the things I found, and also for a number of other scribes, is that a number of these individuals, scribes and low-level managers, were interested in becoming monks. And they eventually took the tonsure. And so this suggests that for some of these people, and I point out in the book, that there's a lot of overlap between the life of someone in the scriptorium. These are lay individuals, I should stress. These are unordained people in working in the scriptorium, staffing it, proofreading manuscripts, working as scribes, working as low-level managers, These are all lay people, but we see some of them aspire to monastic ordination, which suggests, and I show some other evidence that also suggests this, it suggests that a lot of these individuals had an interest in Buddhism to begin with. So for some of them, I argue, it can also be kind of a form of training, a preparation, a way to familiarize yourself with Buddhist practice, to do a practice that's viewed as a pious practice, and kind of work your way up the ladder to becoming a monk. Then a final group is we also have lay individuals of patrons in the provinces, but also in the capital, who might not have the resources to sponsor a sutra copying project together, because we have to remember, this costs money to get the paper, to get the inks, to hire the labor. It costs money. We have examples of people where individuals pool their resources together. So in one case, in Izumi province, I found evidence of a fellowship, I call these fellowships often, where 709 individuals pooled their resources together to copy sutras. So we have, you know, people just donating whatever they have. And we have examples of this for temple construction for Japan, for example, for constructing Todaiji. We have people donating very, very small amounts of money. And even the edict, the imperial edict, initiating Todaiji asked people, you know, even if you can just get a handful of mud, you know, donate that. And so we have these examples, I think, of people from broad social backgrounds engaging in sutra copying. And that was one of the things that really interested me about this project, is we have so many people from so many different backgrounds doing it for so many different reasons that it felt like it was a good way to kind of get at critiquing the state Buddhism model.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier in your answer the a particular approach, you didn't name it, but a particular approach to scripture that you in the book you call, you're following another Buddhist study scholar, you call a non-hermeneutic dimension of engaging scripture. So what is this non-hermeneutic dimension? Because it seems like that's a lot of what you're talking about in the book.
Absolutely. And this is a term, non-hermeneutic dimension of scripture copying, that I borrow from an excellent scholar at Santa Barbara, Fabio Rambelli. And he talks about this in his book, which is a book about Buddhist materiality more generally. But he has a chapter in there on kind of looking at the uses of scripture. And I think put most simply, his is a much more complex model with different types of dimensions. There are a variety of non-hermeneutic dimensions. Mm. But to put it most simply, I think it's the idea that we do things with texts beyond reading them. So when I was a student, and now as a professor, and I hope my students do this too, is, you know, one is assigned or one chooses books, and we read them and we digest their content and we learn things from the books. But that's not the only thing we can do with books. And when I first started my dissertation research, I had a newborn, and you know, as soon as he could crawl, he would take books off the shelf and he would put them in his mouth. He would chew on them, right? And so that's something we can do with a book that's not a hermeneutic dimension. Right? He wasn't interpreting that book. He was getting some relief and gnawing on it. And that was a non-hermeneutic dimension of a book, right? And I talked about a little bit before in my remarks about how in Buddhism we have this idea about merit in copying scripture. But one of the things, as I turned in the introduction and started to look comparatively, is these ideas about non-hermeneutic dimensions of books are widespread. Mm. So an example that might be very familiar to our readers is when the president takes an oath, the oath of office, the president will often put their hand on a Bible, often a very special Bible, right? Like Abraham Lincoln's Bible, or a very special Bible, a family Bible. They put their hand on the Bible and they swear an oath. This is a non-hermeneutic use of scripture that's kind of very familiar to us. So I think that's a very useful way to think about how we think about religious texts more generally, right? That the texts do things beyond finding meaning. And as scholars trained as textualists, we're generally trained to look at texts and read them for meaning. Hmm. But we don't think about the materiality of the text. We don't think about the larger cultic world around the text. And so following Fabio Rambelli and others, I wanted to kind of really look at this aspect, this non-hermeneutic dimension. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I want to gently push back against what I think can be a crude reading of Rambelli's work. I think Rambelli's model is actually much more defined and, as I said, allows for a variety of hermeneutic dimensions. But I think scholars sometimes take this too far. And they say, you know, Buddhist works are only about merit. And no one ever bothers to read them. But I want to gently push back against this in at least two ways. One way is that Buddhist scripture itself, self-referentially, refers to its own copying. It says, thou shalt copy this book, and thou shalt reap great rewards for doing so. And in doing that, I mean, the act of copying in some ways is always an interpretive act to begin with, because in some ways it is an embodiment, it is an enactment of what the scripture itself tells you to do. So it's kind of an embodied interpretation. So that's one way I'm trying to push back against this kind of, against taking the model too far. The second way is that people have to choose which text they copy. And for some, there are texts like the Lotus Sutra, which in certain ways I think is chosen in part because it's kind of claimed to be the best text. And so, you know, you copy the best one. But in other cases, for example, in chapter 6 of my book, I look at the copying of a relatively obscure text that's hardly ever copied again. And why would they copy such an obscure text? You know, it's easy to figure out why they might copy the Lotus Sutra, but why would they copy a text that I previous to encountering it in my research, had never heard of? And so for those reasons, I argue in the book, they choose texts for very particular reasons related to their goals and their aspirations. And so again, in that way, we can see this as kind of an embodied, enacted hermeneutic reading of the text.
So your research relies on a collection of documents that hasn't been used very extensively, at least in English language scholarship. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about this collection, and as well as some other sources that you use to develop your arguments.
Yeah, this is the question that when people ask me at a party and I start to give an answer, my wife starts to elbow me and tell me they don't care that much. They're just being polite. So I always have to be careful not to go in too much detail. But one of the reasons this question requires a great deal of detail is that the collection itself, the archive itself, has a remarkably complex history that both makes the documents very difficult to use as a scholar today, but also has shaped scholarly agendas in ways that the documents have been used with particular biases. So let me just kind of outline the collection really simply. So in short, the collection is in a building known as the Shosoin. The Shosoin is most famous as an imperial treasure house. It's a storehouse for imperial treasures. The documents themselves were not treasures. They probably ended up, we don't know how they ended up in this storehouse, but scholars speculate perhaps they were doing repairs, maybe there was a fire on a neighboring storehouse, and they just kind of moved them in there. So they're not considered the treasures, but the treasures are the things that are the most famous at the Shosoin. The documents themselves are a collection of about 10,000 documents, primarily related to an 8th century Japanese scriptorium, an office or a government bureau for copying sutras. So that sounds relatively simple, right? But they actually have a much, much more complicated history than that. The documents really, you can think of them usefully as having different layers. Some of the first documents were not scriptorium documents at all. They were actually trash. So they ended up in the trash heap of the scriptorium. But what a lot of these documents were that were in the trash heap, or maybe the recycling bin is a better analogy, those that ended up in the recycling bin of the scriptorium, a lot of those documents were things like census records, tax receipts, and things of this nature. So when scholars first discovered these documents, they were really interested in what was kind of in the recycling bin, but they didn't necessarily know that that's what they were looking at. So a lot of social historians were very interested in census records and things of that nature, so they could do things like look at the population of Japan, look at tax policy of Japan. And they would use the documents in a way that one of my teachers described as treasure hunting, where they're just kind of trying to find something interesting in the collection without understanding the collection as a whole. And that treasure hunting term is from one of my teachers, Sakahara Towo. So why is that treasure hunting? Why is that a problem to just find these census records? Well, so those census records and tax registers and things of that nature, as I mentioned, were in the recycling bin. They were taken in the recycling bin, flipped over, used on the verso, on the backside of the manuscript, and then assembled together into new scrolls, sometimes with things that were also recycled from the scriptorium, sometimes with new sheets of paper, but usually often with things that are on the back of them, assembled into new scrolls, and then used as record-keeping documents at the scriptorium. Then sometimes, for example, if the scriptorium had made something on a fresh scroll with nothing on the back, they would then peel these also apart. So they would peel them apart, sometimes cut them apart, and then turn them over and paste them back together into new scrolls. And so it's like a very complicated jigsaw puzzle, right, where you've got things that are already mixed up in the 8th century, things of different origins that have been flipped over and pasted together. But when the scriptorium closed at the end of the 8th century, When the scriptorium closed at the end of the 8th century, there were largely a collection, an archive, related to this sutra copying bureau that also had some things on the back. Mm-hmm. Then they sat there for about 1,000 years, and in the 1830s, a scholar, kind of an antiquarian scholar, known as Hoida Tadatomo, rediscovered these documents and started to study them. And he was very interested in collecting things like seals, mm-hmm. also in things like census records. And what he did is he peeled the documents apart and put them together into a new order based on his own interests. So we had this already complicated jigsaw puzzle that then gets added another layer to it, starting from the 1830s, going up for about another century, where scholars in Japan are again peeling the documents apart, reassembling them into new scrolls, which is the way the documents exist today. Mm. And so the documents have this very, very complicated history to use them, where so for me, someone that's interested in 8th century sutra copying, sometimes two layers removed, you'll have to go back and figure out how the scrolls were reassembled and kind of piece them back in your mind or using computers, piece them back into their original configuration. Fortunately, Japanese scholars at the Imperial Household Agency, at the Historiographical Institute at Tokyo University, have been doing a lot of this work, but they're still only a fraction of the way through of figuring out how these documents originally looked. Mm-hmm. And so it has these very complicated history, but what it also does is it lets you go into depth for studying sutra copying as something that's completely unrivaled in the Buddhist world. To have 10,000 documents from a single institution over a period of roughly a half of a century is just a remarkable amount of depth. And really, worldwide, we don't have any collection like this as an 8th century collection of documents on a single institution related to something like book history in that type of wealth. And so it's really an embarrassment of riches, and we can learn so much in so much depth about a very, very narrow topic. And the Shoshone documents let us do that. Mm-hmm. You also asked about other sources, so let me just briefly say other sources that I use. So in addition to these Shoshone documents, which are really internal record-keeping documents, I also use sutra manuscripts themselves, some of them produced by this bureau, but also those produced in the provinces. I use those. I look at things like the calligraphy. I look at the way the manuscript was produced, but perhaps most helpfully for me is the fact that these manuscripts often have colophones. Very often prayers, but also colophones that will tell us about who copied it, when they copied it, where they were located, but then the prayers too, which will give us a sense of their aspirations. Why did they copy a manuscript? Mm-hmm. So that's a source I use quite frequently. I also use tales, narratives about sutra copying, and then I also use materials from East Asia more broadly. So Dunhuang manuscripts found in a cave in Western China that are roughly contemporaneous, that can overlap and kind of show us shared East Asian Buddhist cultures. I use in translation manuscripts that are from areas even further west, such as Gilgit, South Asian manuscripts. And I also use a variety of other Japanese sources, including chronicles, national histories like the Nihon Shoki and Shoku Nihongi. And I use documents like legal codes and things of that nature to try to get a really, really full picture of religious life on the ground in 8th century Japan.
You've alluded already to a few things about the actual process of carrying out a transcription project, but I wonder if you could talk at a little bit more length about how a transcription project might occur, realizing, of course, that different transcription projects would occur in different ways. For example, in terms of material, personnel, scheduling, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, so there are a variety of sutra copying projects in Japan, and some of them might be really small scale, like I said, where you get some people, they pool some money together, and they fund a very small project. And those we know the least about. There are ways we can study that, and I think, for the most part, I'd say my findings suggest that the basic process of those manuscripts is similar to what I'm going to describe in a moment, which is a much more bureaucratic process. Mm-hmm. And I want to stress that in the answer to this question is, at least, for example, for the Office of Sutra Transcription that I've been talking about, transcribing scripture was, on the one hand, a very bureaucratic process, but also a highly ritualized process. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about the bureaucratic process first. So when I start, I believe it's chapter 4 of my book, I can't remember the numbers, but the introduction of that chapter is a quote, and it says something along the lines of, 347,000 sheets of paper for this, and 283,000 sheets of paper for this, 1,000 rollers for this, you know? And it's just this list of huge, enormous numbers of materials. And one of the things I wanted to communicate in that chapter, and with kind of starting the chapter that way, is just to organize those materials is a bureaucratic feat. And so when you've got multiple projects, sometimes these people are managing, you know, four or five different projects at once, and you've got all these different materials coming from different places in the numbers of thousands and ten thousands of sheets of paper, sometimes even more, it takes a lot of bureaucratic know-how just to copy sutras. Mm-hmm. And so if we can kind of start at the beginning, how does the sutra copying take place? Well, a patron decides they want to copy a sutra, right? And they might have a monk or nun advisor that could help tell them maybe which sutra they want to copy. And they make a vow saying, I'm going to copy the sutra. And then they have to actually do it. And that's when they communicate to this through these lay bureaucratic channels saying, okay, I want to copy the sutra. And the bureaucratic managers that are going to have a lot of experience with this, people like the figure I mentioned before that I studied in one of the chapters, Katakuni no Hitonari, they'll know. They'll say, okay, we're copying these texts. They can do some calculations. I need this much paper. I need this much ink. And they're going to order all of the materials. So they're going to order the supplies, the paper, the rollers, the ink, the brushes, the exemplars, which are the manuscripts from which to copy. Mm-hmm. To copy a sutra, you also need a source text from which to copy. They're going to order all of these things. Sometimes, often, a lot of the employees at the scriptorium are kind of temps that will come in when they have a really big project. So, for example, when the queen consort Komyo died, there was a huge memorial project to copy the canon, about 5,000 scrolls of sutra, in a year. Mm. And they needed all of this labor, so they would have to bring in, you know, 50, 60 people extra to help copy the sutras. So the managers will organize all of that to get it started. Then what they do is they distribute the paper to people that I call assemblers. The name in Japanese is, it depends on what region of Japan you're in. They're either called so-o or so-ko. The characters can be read different ways. I've translated them as assemblers because their job entailed basically assembling the scroll. And so their first job would be to paste the individual sheets of paper into a scroll. Often if they were doing a large project, they would just start with 20 sheets, and then you could add more or take more away as you need later. Then they would line the scrolls with a very thin line using a deer hair brush, which would allow them to do these very, very fine lines. They would engage in a process that seems to be known as pounding, as utsu, which scholars still don't really fully understand, but it might allow the ink to kind of better absorb into the paper. Mm. Then the manuscripts return back to the managers, who will then distribute them to the scribes, who will copy the texts. And the managers then are also kind of all distributing the source text from which they'll copy. Then the manuscripts are given to proofreaders, who will proofread the manuscript twice. To some degree, there are systems of fines in place for mistakes being made.
Wow.
After proofreading, that's returned to the assemblers, and the assemblers will take off a temporary kind of wooden roller that they put on at the beginning. They'll put on a new roller, kind of for the final product, add a string, a cover sheet, things of this nature, and then it's returned again to the managers, and then often the scrolls will be distributed to temples where they will be chanted in a ritual. So that's kind of the bureaucratic aspect, and I ended there with ritual. And the chanting of the sutras at a temple is one ritual, often done at memorial rites and things of that nature, but actually the whole process of scripture, I argue, was a ritualized endeavor. That's why I call the book Ritualized Writing. Right. And so, for example, the people copying the sutras would wear special garments known as pure garments, joe, which are used widely in East Asian ritual and appear in a variety of other contexts. They would often perform ablutions. They would have to abstain from eating meat. There are stories in the narrative literature. I don't have any of this in the manuscript and document evidence. Although I do have one scribe apologizing about misbehaving badly, but who knows who knows what he did. But we also have stories of, for example, a scribe that engages in sexual conduct. It's actually a kind of dark story from a modern perspective, but I think in an 8th century perspective, it's a somewhat humorous story. There's a rainstorm, and the scribe is forced to huddle in this hall with all these women who had been preparing the ink here, known as like pure ink, and they're preparing it, and he's overcome with lust, and he essentially rapes this woman, and both the woman and the scribe die for defiling this kind of sacred space during this sacred act of copying scripture. In later versions of the story are very explicit that, like, when you're copying scripture, you shouldn't be doing these things. And we have stories in later stories of scribes that are constantly going to hell for misbehaving sexually and eating meat and things like that while copying scripture. So there's this larger discourse that is largely also reflected in the manuscript cultures of upholding purity while copying scripture. And then we have these rituals of dedication upon the completion of copying scripture. And that's really what I mean by ritualized writing, is we have this whole series of acts from the moment of transcription through the completion of transcription and beyond it that separates copying sutras from the ways that we ordinarily write when we're, for example, recording a bureaucratic document. When I'm writing this book, we don't engage in all these procedures. And so there, to talk about, how was the project carried out, it's really in two ways that we often don't associate together, I think,
right,
which is bureaucracy and ritual. In a lot of ways, it's kind of a ritualized bureaucracy, which for me was something I hadn't thought about much before looking at this project, is kind of how does bureaucracy relate to ritual? In a lot of ways, bureaucracy can enable very, very highly ritualized endeavors to take place and could enable on a large scale this ritualized writing to take place in Japan.
Mm-hmm. You've alluded to this as well earlier in the conversation, which is the representation of Buddhism in the Nara period that scholars have developed over the years, and which you challenge in this book. You suggest, actually, there are multiple ways that people have understood Buddhism, and you have issues with a number of them, and you suggest that the evidence that you see presents a more complicated picture of Buddhism. You've talked a little bit about state Buddhism in the conversation so far. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the scholarly reconstructions that exist and some of the reasons why you have come out against them.
So the state Buddhism model is the most commonly employed model for understanding Nara period Buddhism. And you encounter this in textbooks, you encounter it in scholarly articles, you encounter it in scholarly articles by scholars who should know better. And my advisor, who I owe a lot of debt to for thinking about kind of historiographical issues, Jackie Stone, kind of described it to me as like a hydra, you feel like you've cut off the head and then more grow back and you can never really, really win. But so the state Buddhism model is the main argument that I'm arguing against. And this argument was most famously and perhaps most influentially introduced by Inoue Mitsuda, and he looks at various aspects of state Buddhism. One, the way that the state is controlled. Sorry, not this. I want to argue how the state is controlled. He wants to argue how Buddhism is controlled by the state.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about state control of Buddhism as being very central. He talks about the state, and by the state he kind of seems to mean, the emperors and the rulers were the largest kind of patrons of Buddhism, so they promoted Buddhism. And then he wants to say, thirdly, that the state relied on Buddhism primarily for its magical qualities, its apotropaic qualities of how it could kind of help protect them, bring them this worldly benefits and things of that nature. So that's the most famous version of the state Buddhism model. And I think there are a lot of problems with it. One, the idea that the state is kind of the primary agent behind Buddhism. Well, that might be true in certain ways because, the rulers have the most amount of resources, so they can build the most amount of temples. But I think it also masks the very active and vibrant Buddhist life on the ground, outside of the capital and outside of the rulers. So as I've mentioned to you, we have cases of 709 villagers pooling together their resources. We have cases of lay women being very active patrons. We have cases of mid-level aristocrats, of scribes. All of these people are lost in a narrative that looks only at the state. So that's one aspect that I'm critical of. Second is with regard to Inoue Mitsuda's model, the state Buddhism idea of the state controlling Buddhism. As scholars such as Yoshida Kazuhiko, who I'm going to turn to in a few minutes, have pointed out, that in part that's a myth. I mean, oftentimes the state wasn't all that effective in controlling Buddhism. So the problems, the things they were trying to control were relatively rampant. And so it's hard to say that a central feature of the age was control, when control was largely, was often a failure. But for me also, one of the things I contribute to that conversation in this book, I think, is to also think about the ways that the state was controlled by Buddhism. That if we think of Buddhism and certain Buddhist ideas about about, you know, ghosts and hauntings and things like that as a discourse, that the rulers were also participating in this discursive field. They weren't puppet masters, you know, controlling things from above. Rather, they also feared that if they didn't behave as pious Buddhists, there would be karmic punishment. And so in some ways, because the rulers were also living in fear of karmic punishment and were doing things like, felt like they had to constantly patronize Buddhism, otherwise they would be punished. And there are sutras that spell this out very explicitly. If you are not a good patron of Buddhism, you will lose your ability to rule. Bandits will come and flourish in your empire, and, you know, everything will go to hell. And the rulers felt that, I think. And I think there's a lot of evidence that I try to show in the book that the rulers felt this and were afraid of this. And so they're not necessarily controlling Buddhism from above. And then I think third, this notion of kind of apotropaic Buddhism misses the diverse forms of Buddhism that are happening on the ground. It also seems to assume that there's kind of some sort of normative Buddhism that's an authentic Buddhism. And we never really see that in Buddhist history. I mean, people are always using Buddhism to gain this worldly benefits, to save their ancestors after they die. And this is not a quality that's connected exclusively to state Buddhism. It's something I think that happens much more broadly. So those are three ways that I criticize the state Buddhism model in the book. The other thing that I would add is, and I've done this in much more detail in the article, but I do it a little bit in the book as well, is that the state Buddhism model is a very modern construction tied to a particular modern history. So I've looked at this in some detail, but starting in the late 19th century, when kind of modern historical methods are first introduced to Japan, this is really when we start to see a lot of the idea that Japanese Buddhism is state Buddhism. But interestingly, we see it used for a variety of ways. For some, after a period when Buddhism had faced some degree of persecution, and the state had been somewhat anti-Buddhism, we see in the modern period, we see modern Buddhist reformers looking to the Nara period as a model, right? So state Buddhism is something we can return to. They have what I've called a nostalgic view of the past, right? So this is a model that we can look to, and we can recreate our present society, and Buddhism can flourish just like it did in the Nara period when it was controlled and sponsored by the state. So that's kind of one origin of this model. Another, in the modern period, we have reformers who are very suspicious about the state's involvement of Buddhism, and they're hypercritical. They want to see religion and the state be separate. And this is a modern idea. The idea that religion and secular are separate spheres is a relatively modern idea, and this has been argued by a number of scholars, Jason Josephson and a number of others, looking kind of more broadly at, you know, religion as a global phenomenon. A lot of these categories are quite modern, and one of the casualties of that modern category of religion is that we have to separate religion and the state, and that made scholars very suspicious about the Nara period when they were so entwined. And then as Japan starts to become more aggressive as an imperial, with kind of an imperial agenda, we start to see national historians. So the first people I was looking at were really largely Buddhist reformers trying to figure out, how can we make Buddhism fit in the modern world? What are the challenges we can respond to? As in the, starting in kind of the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, we start to see historians, national historians, relatively secular historians at the imperial universities looking at Buddhism. And for them, again, we start to see that the Nara period can become a model, but also a danger. So they want to see the state as superior to religion, and religion as subservient to the state. And that's how they interpret the Nara period. Inoue Mitsusada's writing in the post-war period, the scholar that I referenced before, is the most influential period, the most influential voice of the state Buddhism model. He's writing in the post-war period very suspicious of state control of religion, because he had seen some of the dangers of that in the war during World War II, what we call World War II. And so he was very suspicious and very critical of state Buddhism, because for him it kind of reminded him, and he's somewhat explicit about this, I think, it reminded him of the war years. So that's kind of a lot of the problems with the state Buddhism model. And again, it's a large laundry list. The other approach that's come up in recent years by this, really largely by this scholar Yoshida Kazuhiko, but a number of other scholars, is, well, there's not only state Buddhism, Yoshida has wanted to argue, and I think has argued quite effectively. He argues that there are diverse forms of Buddhism. Hmm. So he says there's aristocratic Buddhism, there's state Buddhism, there's kind of popular or folk Buddhism. There are all these different Buddhisms, in the plural, mm-hmm. that simultaneously exist. And in a lot of ways, I'm in agreement with Yoshida Kazuhiko. He's a friend of mine. He's taken me out to dinner before. I'm largely in agreement and supportive of his project. But I do want to kind of push back a little bit against some of his approach, which is, I think when we talk about diverse Buddhisms on the ground, we oftentimes miss some of the shared religious practices across social classes. Second, I think when we talk about popular Buddhism or folk Buddhism, it becomes a very vague catch-all category that also has its kind of very modern history. So Carol Gluck, for example, at Columbia has written about this, but starting in, you know, the 70s, there's a huge turn to look at popular aspects, folk aspects of Japanese culture as kind of a pushback to elite narratives, and this is also kind of a somewhat modern perspective, a very kind of particular historical moment. So I push back against it for that, but also because I think we can understand these shared practices and social divisions that don't necessarily map very clearly on a popular versus elite level. So what do I mean by that? So for example, I look at what I call straddlers. I borrow this term from political science, but political scientists have labeled straddlers grassroots groups that have connections to the states. So these are kind of what, you know, might be things like, you know, NGOs today, but that still have some sorts of connections to state institutions, right? They're engaged in dialogue, they might share information, things like that. I look at these straddlers, which, for example, we have a provincial doctor, which is an official state position. It's a state kind of doctor that's out in the provinces. We have examples of provincial doctors organizing grassroots fellowships on the ground. So that's someone that's connected to the state, but then when you look at their prayers, they're praying for their ancestors and things like this. And so we have something that's much more complicated, right? We have a local grassroots organization on the ground that also has connections to the state, right? So is that popular? Is it state? Well, it's not necessarily one or the other, and I think we need to use models like straddlers to maybe understand that better. I use models a little bit of networks. This is something I'm hoping to develop more in my second book project. But for example, the bureaucratic agencies that I looked at, the sutra copying bureaus, we can see the ways that those might be a node on a network that they can share their resources with other smaller scriptoria, and we have examples of this. They'll send laborers over to smaller scriptoria. They'll send supplies sometimes. Sometimes individuals that have connections to the scriptoria, personal connections, can use the connections of the main scriptorium in the capital, this Office of Sutra Transcription, to conduct some of their own, what are labeled in the documents as private copying. And so this really blurs boundaries, right? Is it an official government institution? Well, clearly it is, but it also can serve other purposes that are maybe much more private and labeled as such in the documents. So those are some models that I've looked at to kind of complicate this. And I also think the distinctions between popular and elite are relatively crude because their memorial ritual, for example, is something that people at all aspects of society are doing. And so when we just kind of divide society into two or three or four groups and we assume that religious practice mirrors those social groups, that's a very particular type of sociological argument that I think Yoshida and others are kind of unconsciously making, right? That it's in some ways based on a certain type of Marxist, I think, understanding that the religious practice is a reflection of social class. And I want to see a much more dynamic interaction between religious practice and social class, and that also that religious practice can be generative of social groups. So one of the things I argue in the book too is we see new forms of social organizations in Japan emerge, such as groups that are known as kind of virtuous or good friends, zenshishiki, that form together as groups of religious practice and that cross all sorts of different social lines in terms of class, but also even geographic lines. So we'll have people from various districts in Japan joining together to form these groups. And so we can have new forms of social organization emerging that are largely religiously defined, right? Groups of practice, groups that might uphold precepts together, groups that might engage to worship a particular deity together. And these are religious groups, groups that are social groups that are formed in part by religious motivations. And so I don't think it's necessarily always useful to just assume kind of these class-based models of emperors, aristocrats, folk. I think it's better to use terms like friendship and terms like straddlers that can, I think, better capture the actual social organizations on the ground in Japan.
Right. And, I mean, in your the last two chapters of your book kind of approach Japanese, what you've been talking about, in incredibly complex detail by looking specifically at a specific individual and at a specific event. And these two chapters you call micro histories, which is kind of a trend in historical studies. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, and you already have to some degree, but if you could talk a little bit about what these two chapters are doing, what's going on in these two chapters, and what your reasons were for having micro histories appear in this book. And then I'm kind of showing a bias by asking you about the person rather than the event, because the event to me seems kind of significant. But why did you pick the particular person that you did to focus on in the one chapter that you looked
at? Yeah, no, that's really helpful. So microhistory is something, I mean, a number of scholars, particularly in history departments, less so, I would say, for Buddhist studies, it's been a methodology that hasn't been very well employed in my perspective. So I feel like I was bringing something a little bit new in Buddhist studies by doing these microhistories. But this, of course, is a variety of scholars have done it, but I think most famously Carlo Ginzburg and The Cheese and the Worms is kind of the classic example of a microhistory, which I actually read relatively late in my research, after I'd kind of already I think I came across the term microhistory after I'd already been doing microhistories to some degree. But it was a very useful way for me to think about what I'm doing and kind of what are some of the advantages. So I think one of the biggest advantages of microhistory, of looking at kind of an individual in precise detail or a particular kind of year in very precise detail, is that it shows fissures with these grand narratives. So the grand narrative that I'm fighting against, and I should add the one other thing about the state Buddhism model I forgot to mention in my winded example before, is that the state Buddhism model is part of a larger master narrative of Japanese Buddhism, which sees a progression from the state Buddhism of the Nara period to a popular Buddhism of the Kamakura period. And the Kamakura period is a period later in Japanese history, beginning in the 12th century, that's said to be that numerous sects were founded in that later came on to be the most important and powerful sects in Japan, including contemporary Japanese Buddhism. So scholars, starting in the 19th century largely, looked back to the Kamakura period as the founding of authentic Buddhism in Japan, right? And this goes back to these issues of authenticity. And so the master narrative of Japanese Buddhism is Buddhism was this corrupt, state-run entity until these reformers, who are sometimes likened to Luther in these narratives, came and reformed Buddhism and brought true Buddhism to the masses for the first time, and then we all lived happily ever after, except for this little blip in the Tokugawa period. Everything got corrupt again before being saved again by reformers in the modern period. That's the essential narrative that people have told about Japanese Buddhism. I found, to kind of overcome the state Buddhism aspect of that master narrative and to overcome some of these narratives more generally, a microhistory, I think, in general, often shows these fissures, right? When you look at something from a macro perspective, you have these grand narratives. When you look at how things are actually happening in the lives of everyday people, it's never so simple. So that's why I kind of got attracted to this approach, even before I really had encountered kind of the concept of a microhistory. So I look at two different individuals, and I intentionally tried to choose individuals from very different social backgrounds. I should say clusters of individuals. So in chapter 5, I look at an individual known as Karakuni no Hitonari, who I've mentioned a couple times so far, who's a, kind of a low mid-level manager, but also worked as a scribe and a proofreader, and then goes on to become a monk. The other looks at a cluster of individuals in a single year when a sutra copying project has happened, but mostly looking at the queen consort Komyo and her daughter Princess Abe, who's about to ascend the throne as empress. And I wanted to look at two radically different social classes, in part in response to what I was talking about with Yoshida Kazuhiko's work, is I didn't want to just look at the popular, right? Just look at the kind of the grassroots, low-level people. I wanted in this book throughout, and I tried to do that in all of the chapters, I juxtaposed my bureaucratic, in my kind of social organizations chapters, really grassroots organizations with highly bureaucratic ones. And so I try to kind of go back and forth between social classes and chapters to some degree. So I wanted people from different backgrounds. Karakuni no Hitonari, I came across, it was rather serendipitous. I was a very naive graduate student. Like I said, I was an extraordinarily ignorant graduate student when I started, and I did my graduate studies at Princeton University in New Jersey, and the librarian there, one of the librarians for the, who's now the head of the East Asian Library, Martin Hydra, he does these rare book showings every year for the graduate students. It's a wonderful thing that he does. I hope he still does them. And he always asks the grad students, is there anything you want to see? And well, I'm interested in Japan in the Nara period, and I'm interested in Buddhism. Like, if you have anything that's really old in Buddhist, like the older the better, I'd love to see what you have. And he's like, gosh, I don't know what we have. Let me take a look. And he went in and he found 2 8th century Japanese Buddhist scrolls that had actually been produced from this scriptorium that I've been talking about in some detail today, that Princeton had purchased a long time ago and kind of collected dust up until then.
Completely changed your life.
It really did. I mean, it was kind of amazing. I had thought about doing stuff related to sutra copying, but I didn't really know much. And then, you know, I was, in addition to being an ignorant graduate student, I was a poor graduate student with a child. And it was mentioned to me that there was a prize that, like, you got some money. I can't remember how much, but it's like $500. It sounded like this incredible amount of money as a grad student, you know. It was like, pay for groceries for, you know, a very long time. If you wrote something on something in the rare books collection. So I said, gosh, you know, this could be a good way to start doing some dissertation research. It could, you know, feed my young family for a little bit of time. It seems somewhat interesting, so maybe I'll learn something. It turned out one of the manuscripts was transcribed, and I could find out through using these Shosuin documents I've talked about. I could figure out the individual who transcribed this one particular manuscript, and there was this individual known as Kadokunino Hitonari, and there were two manuscripts, but one manuscript, we didn't know much about the individuals involved. Kadokunino Hitonari, because he spent part of his career as an administrator, we had a huge amount of records about him. The other thing that attracted me to him immediately was he seems to have become a monk. We have a record of his request listing the sutras he can chant and all of these things that he can do, where he was asking if he could become a monk. And he disappears from Shosuin records after that moment, which suggests that indeed he had been, you know, active there for a number of years, that indeed he became a monk. And so I was interested in scribes that became monks. And so right before me, I had a manuscript, I had a character with all of this data about that we could do a microhistory on, and he had an interesting story to tell, and one I thought that would kind of challenge this narrative. Now, I had to situate him, because all of the documents are fragmentary to an extent that sometimes I would have to kind of read the broader context of what his life was like at the scriptorium. But again, we had a lot of information about him, including Chinese poems he had written. And so we could get a really rich, textured portrayal of him. And one of the things I wanted to do with him is kind of challenge this notion of state and popular. Because he's a popular figure in the sense that he's a low-ranking figure, or a figure without rank, but he's also very much tied to state institutions. So I kind of want to reassess how we think about state institutions. And I want to think about a state institution as, and I use a kind of model of disciplinary regimes, which is somewhat Foucauldian in thinking about discipline and regime, but using it also in kind of an older sense of a regime like a regiment that we use for self-improvement, right? So we think of a regime often as kind of a form of government that is has too much power and often uses that power for unsavory purposes. But also we can think of regime as like a regiment that we engage in as a sense of practice that we use to better ourselves. I'm playing with these two meanings. Similar, discipline. No one likes to be disciplined. I know my children certainly don't. But also, we also learn to self-discipline ourselves over time, right? So I want to think about kind of disciplinary regimes. Think of this institution as a place that does have certain rules in place and in certain ways is controlling the lives of individuals. But also, if we look at it from the perspective of that individual, we can think of ways that it might be helping some of their goals, such as becoming a monk. And so I want to kind of look at that play and look at a decidedly bureaucratic state institution, but undermine that view of it a little bit from looking at it from through the eyes of Kadokunino Hitonari. So that's why I was attracted to him. In the next chapter, the next microhistorical chapter, chapter 6, I'm trying to do the opposite. So I'm looking at a project to copy 3 sutras that seem to have been copied, I argue, as a set, because they're copied largely at the same time. I mean, 2 of them to the day for the order. They share a lot of thematic similarities. There's a ton of connections between these 3 projects. And nothing else is happening at the scriptorium at this time. They had actually stopped copying a few months before when someone had died. And then someone actually very substantial had died because it's the retired empress, which allows the current emperor to abdicate the throne to his daughter. So that had all just happened. And then they stopped copying sutras for a while. They resumed sutra copying with two projects. Then they add a third. And then they finally get back to what they'd been doing 6 months before. So they seem to be really important projects that are tied together. And I look at those projects through the lens of the crown princess, who's about to become the empress. She is the first woman named crown princess, which is like the heir to the throne. She will be like the first person, the first woman to rule without like any clear heir to the throne coming after her. She's childless. So it's a time that's kind of fraught with difficulty and uncertainty in Japanese history. And at this moment, her mother, who is the queen consort, Komio, sponsors these projects, including one that I became initially interested in, the scripture on saving and protecting body and life. And this one was also somewhat serendipitous, how I got interested in this project, because I was taking a graduate seminar in Japan on the Shosuin documents with Sakahata Towa, who's a wonderful individual and the kind of one of the great scholars of Shosuin documents. I was in his seminar, and the way the seminar worked is every student had to give a presentation over a period of two or three classes on one sutra copying project. You had to get all of the documents from that project and walk the class through them over, I mean, hours. Each class is like 3-4 hours. So you spend like 8-10 hours just presenting on these documents, you know, going through them one by one. And so I chose this project because I'd never heard of the sutra. It's called the Scripture on Saving and Protecting Body and Life. It sounded interesting to me. And I'd never heard of it. And it was copied in 100 copies, this one moment in the Nara period. And I said, gosh, what is going on at this moment? So that's how I got interested in it. And what I wanted to argue in that chapter is by looking through the eyes of the rulers of Komio and Princess Abe, is we could see things like fear. We could see insecurity. And we could see the need to be a strong Buddhist patron so that you could ward off ghosts and invite good fortune. And that isn't necessarily a control of Buddhism. So I wanted to look at the way that the elites in some ways weren't puppet masters, right? That they were also, as I said before, that they were also in certain ways controlled by Buddhism. And so in those micro-histories, I want to kind of take both the popular narrative and turn it on its head by connecting the popular to the state, taking the state and kind of turning it on its head, and using a micro-historical approach to do so. And I hope it was effective.
Yeah. You've had nice things to say about a lot of scholars during our conversation. I use that as a background for asking the final question, which is has to do with critiquing rival models, which you've also talked about in our conversation, critiquing rival models of Nara period Buddhism. So when you do that, I mean, you talk about how much contemporary concerns play a role in reconstructing the past. Presumably, those contemporary concerns affect anybody who's writing about this period of time, including yourself. So I'm wondering what kinds of strategies you use to minimize that kind of thing happening in your own work, and whether you have this feeling that no matter how much you try, those kinds of concerns are always going to find their way into your work. So this is kind of a broader sort of historiographical, philosophical question.
Well, thank you for saying I've been kind to other scholars. I really want to.
I
try to be critical in my book of models and try to advance new models. But I do also want to recognize that all of the scholars that I'm criticizing function kind of in their own time period, and second, that I benefit tremendously from all of their work. I mean, I wouldn't be able to write this book without all of the wonderful work by. Particularly, you know, my Japanese colleagues who have just done so much work on the Nara period in the past, but also by my colleagues writing in English and in French as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm more directly to your question now about strategies that I've used to kind of minimize this and things like that. I mean, to one extent, I think we can't avoid this, right? We're always products of our own time. And it's unavoidable. It's just a part of how the humanities writing works. I do think one thing has changed a little bit compared to, for example, 19th century scholars. I think we've been trained to be much more reflective and much more self-aware of our circumstances. And I think that's because of the post-colonialist critiques that have come, because of kind of genealogical methods that have become such standard fare in graduate training. I think we've all learned to reflect a lot on where we stand and what are some of the problems in our position, how that might influence our work. But we can't avoid it. And I don't think that's a bad thing, though. I mean, I think it's really useful to be aware, but I think we should also remember that as scholars, we're always translating, right? I'm not writing for an 8th century Japanese Buddhist audience. Hmm. They probably wouldn't find my work particularly interesting. Some of the things about ritualized writing, they would probably find rather obvious, right? Like, of course writing is ritualized. Like, why is that surprising to you? But what is the strange word ritual that you're using? What we're doing as scholars, I think, is we're always translating materials for our contemporary audiences. Mm-hmm. No matter what we're doing, we're writing for people that live and exist today, and hopefully we're writing things that are meaningful for them. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's why studying ancient Japanese history is so interesting. I mean, I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire, and I certainly didn't grow up dreaming of like studying 8th century Japanese Buddhism. I didn't know that was possible. I mean, I haven't gone back in a while, but I remember in grad school being back and, you know, being at like a neighborhood barbecue or something with my parents and telling people what I'm doing, and they said, you could do that, you know. But I think there's value in doing it, in studying things ancient, and it's precisely because we're translating. Mm-hmm. Because we're translating, and not just in the sense of translating text, which is incredibly valuable, but translating ideas and concepts. And the reason I think it's valuable is twofold, right? We see things that are radically different worlds. I think 8th century Japan in a lot of ways is a radically different world than the world we live in. And I think that alterity can be really helpful because it helps us reflect on what our own assumptions are in our world, right? How can our own world be different? Well, we can look at other models. We can see ways that are different, and we can see this alterity in ways that might point out fissures in our own way of thinking. And I think that's really helpful. The other thing I think looking at ancient history can do, and why we're always translating, why it's helpful to be speaking to contemporary audiences, is that we can also see these similarities. Right, we can see ways that we think we're so different. We think we're so modern, but here we are still swearing over a Bible at an inauguration. Mm. Right, we're still living in certain types of fears. Mm. Our politics and our religion are not as separate as we think they are. And so, by studying the ancient past, I think in a lot of ways, and by translating the ancient past, it's very helpful for thinking about who we are today. And I think that's valuable. And so, I don't think there's actually necessarily a problem to be speaking to contemporary audiences. I think if we can do it in a reflective way, it's actually the most valuable work we can be doing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you again for this conversation, Brian.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Again, I've been talking with Brian Lowe, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Vanderbilt, about his recent book, Ritualized Writing, Buddhist Practice and Scriptural Cultures in Ancient Japan, which is part of the Kuroda Institute Studies in East Asian Buddhism series published by the University of Hawaii Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.